to move into a panel discussion. The first question that I have is for Liz and Kate. Can you discuss how state or local government can go about incorporating behavior change considerations in the initial design of a program that they're developing?
So this is Liz. I'll take a first shot, and then Kate, you've got your more recent experience you can talk about since you've just been doing this. I think one of the key aspects is finding those partners and really understanding, you know, Kate had a great list of partners and understanding what they're seeing on the ground so you can really drill down on what is that behavior you want to change. I'll just give an example of a program I worked on here in Vermont around thermal efficiency. And, you know, what folks were looking for was going all the way to weatherization, right? They wanted folks to invest in thermal efficiency projects, which is often a five-figure investment. And after doing the conversations with folks on the ground, you know, where we got to was the behavior we wanted to change was people's understanding of their own homes, really understanding that the work was needed, and move forward with a program that was interactive and educational and lots of fun about Button Up Vermont, where people came and learned about what they could do. It eventually led over time to bigger investment in weatherizing their homes, but really where we had to get to was changing people's understanding of how their home system worked and their belief that something could be different, that houses didn't have to have holes in them. So you really have to start with the partners on the ground to understand what those barriers are before you figure out what your behavior is. So I'll stop there.
All right, this is Kate. I'd like to echo just the incredible importance that our stakeholders and our partners team and the impact that they had on the design of the program and the reach of the program, and I think overall the success of our program. From the beginning, we knew that trying to have this transportation behavior change was quite a challenge. So we used all of the theories from community-based social marketing that we were able to, and luckily we were able to actually attend the in-person training from Doug McKenzie Moore. So I think the commitment was really important, creating a way through our Clear the Air Challenge website that all of our participants really made a very obvious commitment to what they were doing. And once they created a profile on our website, that was public on our website. So it was a public commitment, and you could actually see the progress that they had made in terms of their reductions. I think the wide variety of communications tools was also very important, and enlisting our community leaders and those trusted community organizations to capitalize on trusted and embedded sources in the community that were able to capitalize on their networks to help us spread the word. And I think the recognition was important. I know the recognition was important for especially our businesses that participated. And we found through our experience that the businesses were the ones who were the most enthusiastic participants in this program. They saw it as, you know, a resource that they could provide to their employees that showed civic engagement, was a benefit to their employees, and they had a lot of fun with it. But they really wanted, in the end, that award where they were able to come up and shake the governor and the mayor's hands and have their pictures taken and to have that sense of pride that they had done it.
Great, thank you. My next question is for both Kara and Kate. How can state and local governments effectively measure or assess changes in behavior resulting from their climate and energy programs?
Well, this is Kara, and I mean, I think that some good examples were just given in the presentation. I know from some work that we did about a year ago, analyzing 670 different climate communication outreach efforts, including a number from state and local governments, as well as the nonprofit community. And one of the big things that our survey and interviews resulted in was really seeing that measurement was a huge gap for a lot of practitioners that it's often hard enough to get the time and resources to do effective planning to launch a campaign. And people generally want to be doing a better job measuring, but it's often sort of the last thing. The other piece that tends to come up, too, is that there's actually the possibility to measure a whole lot now, in particular because of some of the online tools. But for some people, there's a sense of drowning in that you sort of see how there are different responses to your social media campaigns. But how do we get at some of the deeper questions, like how did we actually, you know, shift the conversation long term? Did we affect the values and norms? And I think there are a lot of really interesting tools. I mean, again, I think some were mentioned in the presentations today, but, you know, there are some interesting efforts to use sentiment analysis tools to really track how conversations and influencers within them are shifting the discourse and the frames that they're using. There's also some interesting tools being developed to really track more network-based peer-to-peer outreach strategies. So there's a very good case study online from Minnesotans United campaign that was around freedom to marry work in Minnesota. And they basically created a database and tracked a million conversations that they helped launch on the topic throughout the state through a whole network-based strategy. So I think there are a lot of interesting things to look at now, but I do feel this is an area where, you know, we probably all could focus a little bit more and make some of the measurement tools quite simple to use, which some of these more experimental ones are not necessarily in that category.
Mrs. Kate, I talked about it towards the end of the presentation, the different ways that we tried to track our success. And, I mean, the main components of that were tracking transportation data. So a lot of it is self-reported through the tracker. We did monitor it for accuracy and would follow up with anyone who was an outlier in any way. So a lot of that was self-reported. We did do some work on looking at UDOT's transportation data on their highways. That's really the hard tracking part of it. And then each year that we ran the challenge and each year of the Climate Showcase Communities grant, we did survey the Salt Lake County population. And I did talk about that a little bit, but it was really two main parts of that survey. And one was to gauge their understanding of their feelings towards the air quality issue, if it was getting better, if it was getting worse, if they knew who was, you know, what the top contributors were. And we did see some shifts over the years in terms of very high knowledge. I mean, towards the end, you know, we were able to say our population fully understands the scope of our air quality problem, and they fully understand that they are a significant part of that problem. Now we need them to more actively change their behavior. So that surveying had that component, and then it also went into the barriers and benefits related to alternative transit.
Great, thank you for your responses. And I'll just mention that in addition to developing the communications framework that I mentioned earlier, EPA is also working to put additional information on our website for other parts of program design and implementation, one of which will focus on monitoring and evaluation. So we'll be providing more step-by-step in-depth guidance on tracking and assessing the results of your climate and energy work, which ties in very closely to looking at the results of specific communications components. So do be on the outlook for that. So I realize that we're coming to the end of our time. I'm going to ask our speakers just to stick around for a little bit more. Hopefully we can get about one audience question in per speaker. But I know folks are going to start dropping off. So before that, I just want to pull up our communications framework once again and leave that up on the screen. Because as folks leave the webcast today, you'll see an opportunity in the outgoing questionnaire to provide more specific thoughts on this framework and how it may be useful to you and any additional steps or you know, pieces that we might want to consider including. So thank you for in advance for providing feedback as you leave today. And with that, I'll turn it over to Lauren to kick off our Q&A session with audience questions.
Great. Thanks, Emma. And I'm just going to cycle through and do one question per speaker just because we're a little limited on time. The first question for Liz, a participant asked, if you have any other strategies you could share for using group or social pressure to encourage people to change their behavior, for instance, carpooling rather than driving alone. Also, do you find that people are more likely to change their behavior if a fee is involved?
So on the I think really the way we look at that is about changing social norms. You know, and while there needs to be that tension that Kara referenced, you know, shaming doesn't work long term. It does actually work short term, so you can always take that into account. But it does make things a little challenging for people. But on the community-based social marketing website, there are lots and lots of examples that you can find, and also, you know, I can tweet some out if you look at the ISC Twitter feed. I'll put some out there this afternoon of examples that are known in terms of changing social norms to change behavior. Walk to School has been one that has been very effective in communities. And then from a fee standpoint, anything you can do with financial incentives, even if they are small, tends to get people attention. And so that is both in the penalizing the behavior you do not want and rewarding the behavior you do. So money often talks.
Great. Thank you for that response. And then the next question for Kara. Would you be able to clarify some strategies for how to express facts? The participant understands that knowledge does not equal behavior change, but also that people need to understand what's going on.
Yeah, and I do think it's both, and you really need to think about how to embed your facts in a story. One model that I think is very helpful is the role of public narrative in social change, which is a model from Marshall Ganz at Harvard. And it's basically where you are creating a narrative that includes who you are and what your background is with the sort of urgent issue that you want to put forth to people and, you know, the challenge, choice, and opportunity. So it's operationalizing that framework. At first, when you try it, because it is a different way of communicating, it is more of a values-based way, it can feel awkward, but what I've found is that the more you try it on, the more it becomes very, very comfortable. So an example of actually applying that, we were advising the Oregon Global Warming Commission on the rollout of their roadmap for implementing the climate plans to meet the carbon reduction goals. And the presentation that was being put together was, you know, very technical and science-based and what the projections were for climate and whatnot. But we coached the commissioner to embed that in a story of, like, who he was and why he had decided to chair the commission. And when he looked at the data, what did it make him feel as, you know, a citizen of Oregon and as a grandfather and a father and whatnot? And that ended up working quite well. I think the other thing, though, is that stories and narrative is a lot about an exchange. It's not just coming up with message points. And so a lot of what I've heard that's working all across the country is when public outreach sessions are designed to still have sort of the expert presentation kicking things off, ideally set within a narrative structure like that, but where it's really a dialogue-based exchange and where as quickly as possible you're trying to break the conversation down into exchanges with stakeholders or community members amongst themselves, because having a discussion with a sort of peer or fellow resident is a very different conversation than challenging an expert you know. So that's another technique that a lot of people are using. There's a good resource, a lot of resources around deliberative dialogue that you can find online and ways to do this. And there was some really interesting research done by World Resources Institute and Union of Concerned Scientists using this kind of peer-to-peer dialogue model for engaging citizens in conversations about sea level rise that worked extremely well because it was more story and dialogue-based and sort of got people around the arguing of the science. So hopefully that'll help with a few directions looking at Marshall Gann's public narrative work. Some of that is available on our website. But then, you know, some of these deliberative dialogue models that are being used in community outreach.
Excellent response. Thank you so much. And then the last question for Kate, a participant asked, if you were able to measure the direct effect your project had on reducing PM2.5 emissions, and if so, how were you able to document that the reductions were due to outreach and not other factors, which understandably is something difficult to quantify? And they were also, you know, wondering if you were able to decouple results from other programs.
So that's a question that we get a lot, and all of the efforts basically in the Salt Lake Valley continue to get that question. And we, when we go to our Department of Air Quality to have that conversation, they always explain to us how complex our airshed is and how it's just not possible to quantify an effort like the Clear the Air Challenge with direct PM2.5 reductions. And actually, the Clear the Air Challenge generally runs in the summer when ozone is a problem for us. So we have had those conversations, and we've had very long expert explanations as to why we can't make a direct correlation. Anecdotally, we are right on that hairline edge of compliance for ozone now, and our air quality continues to improve. And really, when we've looked at the UDOT traffic counts and seen a significant decrease in traffic on our poor air quality days, we have to chalk it up to all of our combined efforts and what we're doing. And we think that's an important part of that conversation, is that it's not just one person's effort that's reducing our pollution and changing our habits. We'd love to find some way to, but we haven't answered that question.
Great. Thank you to all of our speakers for your responses to questions. Any audience questions that we haven't been able to get to on the air today, we will be responding to in writing and posting to the EPA website with the rest of the files for the webcast, so be on the outlook for those in the coming weeks. I'd like to thank everyone for tuning in today. Please, as you leave, take a minute to fill out the optional questionnaire and also sign up for the third installment of this series, which will be next Wednesday. And thank you again to our speakers for all your time and expertise. We really appreciate you sharing your experience and knowledge with us. And hopefully we will hear or everyone will join us again for the call next week. Thank you.